Today is Saturday, June 17th, 2000. This morning, in the Fireside Room, Paul Olson continues his series entitled Great Stories You Need to Know. Today's topic is entitled The Truth Shall Make You Free. This is session 2 OLP 2000-5. Let's listen in.
The name of this session is You Shall Know the Truth and the Truth Shall Make You Free. That's what's on the cover of my dissertation. As an English student, my motivation for studying African American literature was I didn't know it. And some of you have shared this story. I had finished my master's degree and was started on the PhD. And a friend of mine, a good friend, who was black, we were living together, and he said, you know what Richard Wright says in Native Son? And I said to him, who's Richard Wright? I had been at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, a very good school. I had a great background in English literature. I had been at the University of Minnesota for a history major. And I had finished, as I said, my master's degree at the University of Oregon in American literature. And I didn't know who Richard Wright was, or any other black writer either. This was 1970. It was wrong, and it changed my whole life. And then, fortunately, I was at a university where you could pick the different majors that you had to make up what the PhD would be, and I picked American and African American literature. But if I hadn't picked it myself, I could have gone on with Shakespeare and Keats and Shelley and all, you know, the dead white guys, right? Guys, underlined, dead, underlined, white, underlined. And they're great and they're worthy of study, and I paid attention to them too. But if we got into an argument, we won't, but if I ever did, I would argue with you that Richard Wright is as great and as important and as good a writer, as good an artist as John Steinbeck, that Langston Hughes is as good a poet as, name it, Robert Frost, that Gwendolyn Brooks surely is as good a poet as Robert Frost. And I'm not here to do that, but what I felt, and that's why how a white kid from northern Minnesota with Norwegian heritage got interested in this issue of justice in the canon, and then what started out as issues of justice. Sounds kind of hokey, but if I had you in class for 11 weeks, you'd get it, I think. What started out as issues of justice in the canon changed into issues of love. Love for the literature, love for the people with whom, black and white, that I got to exchange discussion about this literature. So we get to do that today. So, the truth shall make you free. And I was free of this canon that had been handed down to college students for years and years and years and years. So now I get the students that I have in class who are going to go on, I mean, lots of them are English education majors, so they're going to go out and teach in the high schools. Well, when somebody says, have you heard of Richard Wright? Yeah, I have. As a matter of fact, we're going to study. Good.
Is he still only taught in the black studies, or is he now included in the...
Yes. It's both, and I think, at least at Augustana, and I think in good curriculums, you're going to see the black writer integrated into the system, so that, or the white writer integrated into the black system, however you want to talk about that. But, in our English department has discussed this. Does that mean then if you're going to teach Toni Morrison's Beloved in contemporary American literature that you don't need African American literature? And the answer unanimously was, no, we need both, because we're way behind. And so students need to, I think of the young gal or guy who's going to go out and teach high school English, my experience was you don't teach something you haven't been taught, you know, because you're so insecure anyway. So this helps, and anyway, that all goes on. Okay, so I thanks to your great storytelling last night, Ted, my Paul, hi, Ted. I brought along a poem that's famous in African American literature by a poet that's not so famous, Robert Hayden, called Middle Passage. And I've highlighted some parts, and if we get to this, and if you want to, I'll hand out parts, and you can read them. And there are three parts to this. I've taken the longest part, because just drop it in front of you, that's a dry addition. My son's an actor, and those are the hardest things to do, he says. They just give you the script and do it. But, okay, there's one. And who's got two? Somebody else want to read? There you are.
Oh, I didn't bring my glasses.
Okay, sorry. Somebody with their glasses. And those back. We'll come to this, so just set that aside for a moment. This was the phrase, truth, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Richard Wright, in one of his nonfiction works, White Man Listen, which has now been incorporated into the back part of the new publication of Black Boy, said...
one second, folks. Are we keeping these? Can I make notes on it? Did you want this back?
You can make notes on it. If you like it enough, I'll get my own copy.
I like it enough.
In White Man Listen, or now it's Black Boy, Richard Wright said, I suddenly stumbled upon the secret hidden core of race relations in the United States, and that core is this. No one is expected to speak honestly about the problem. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. And later he says, in the same essay, telling the truth is the hardest thing on earth. Try it sometime and sweat will break upon you. It's harder than fighting in a revolution and taking part in a war. I use that quote in class, of course, and I always tell students, I dare you to tell me you don't like my tie. I don't ever wear ties anymore, but tell me, geez, that jacket's kind of stupid looking. It's not. But if that were the truth, and you don't care, good. If that were the truth, I wouldn't say it anyway, right? And that's what Wright means, but we get into heavier things. How come all the black kids sit together in the cafeteria? Well, we're not going to ask that question, because it's harder than fighting in a revolution. It's harder than taking part in a war. But, again, we come back to the title of the session, You Shall Know the Truth, and the Truth Shall Make You Free. In 1929, well, I'll skip up a little bit, and I'll give you the dates, not because they're important, but because they set up a chronology. In 1960, I sat in a junior high, I was a junior in high school, and I sat in a class with a great teacher, motivating, knowledgeable, master's degree in history, probably the most important role model in my life, next to my father. And he said to this class, you know, slavery really wasn't so bad. And all of us, he included, this good guy with all good intentions, he would never harm anybody, he would never discriminate deliberately against one person. But this is a racist education, right? He's not a bigot, but the educational system, and I'll illustrate what I mean. This happened in 1960 from this good man. Slavery really wasn't so bad. In 1929, a book came out that was called American Negro Slavery. 529 pages long, written by a guy named Ulrich Phillips, who was a slave sympathizer. This book, listen to the title, American Negro Slavery. It becomes, for a while, for many, the definitive book describing slavery. In these 529 pages, I've only read part of it because it's a pretty disgusting book, but I have read all the footnotes. And there are something like, I don't remember, let's just say there are 600 footnotes. One refers to a black writer. And yet he's describing slavery. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Is his concept of slavery going to be anywhere near accurate? And then along comes a teacher who goes to college at Hammond University, the University of Minnesota, and looks at this history book that's describing what history is, and he comes and tells his kids 20 years later, you know, slavery really wasn't so bad. Who's at fault? One of the things I'm illustrating is that this is what racist education is about, the power of the institution to shape values and minds and to make judgments about it. This one footnote, by the way, was a statistic from W.E.B. Du Bois' essay on shipping logs or something. I mean, something just innocuous and unimportant, but he had one in there anyway. Well, his conclusion was, in his last paragraph, goes something like this, and I trust you can travel as far south as Louisiana and Mississippi before, and you will never find a slave uncontented. That's the book ends that way. And he establishes over and over again that slavery was not so bad. I'm just setting us up to build kind of a foundation for the poetry that we'll look at. Bullwhip Days is the slaves, remember, is an oral history. It's a wonderful, all of them are very short. I just have a couple excerpts, and I've picked so that I don't take all day on this. Here are the slaves talking, and I'll read it as they've been recorded. I remember just as good as if it was yesterday what Mammy Mary said when she told us the first news of our freedom. You all is free now, she said. You don't none of you belong to Mr. Lardnorth nor Mr. Alec no more. But I does hope you will stay with them, because they will always be just as good to you as they done been in the past. Me, I weren't even studying nothing about leaving Marster Alec. But Sarah Ann and Aunt Mary, they throwed down their hose and just whooped and hollered because they was so glad. When them Yankees come to our place, Mammy Mary asked them if they weren't tired of war. What does you know about war, they asked her right back. No, us won't never get tired of doing good, being in the war and fighting against this. Slavery wasn't so bad, I don't know, but there's two slaves that put down their hose and whooped and hollered, he said. I mean, okay, you get the point. I'll skip up to just a couple more, again, just to set the tone for this poetry that's now going to move way up into the 20th century. A slave. Slavery was the worst days that was ever seen in the world. There was things past telling, but I got the scars of my old body to show this day. I seen worse than what happened to me. I seen them put the men and women in the stock with their hands screwed down through holes in the board and their feet tied together and the naked behinds to the world. Solomon the overseer beat them with a big whip and Massa look on. The niggers better not stop in the fields when they hear them yelling. They cut the flesh most to the bones, and some they was when they taken them up out of the stock and put them on the beds, they never got up again. And when a nigger died, they let his folks come out to the fields to see him before he died. They buried him the same day. Take a big plank and bust it with an axe in the middle enough to bend it back and put the dead nigger in betwixt it. They'd cart him down then to the graveyard and the place and not bury him deep enough that buzzards wouldn't come circling around. Niggers mourn now, but in them days there wasn't no time for mourning.
Just a couple more.
When a slave died, we just dug a hole in the ground, built a fence around it, and piled him in. No singing, no preaching, or praying ever took place during slavery time. Master would say, well, he was a pretty good Negro. Guess he'll go to heaven all right. And that was about all there was to a Negro funeral then. We would not even shed a tear because he was gone where there would not be any more slaves. That was all the slave thought about then, not being a slave, because slavery time was hell. 1929, Ulrich Phillips, American Negro Slavey. I trust you can travel as far south as Mississippi and you will never find an uncontented slave. 1960, slavery really wasn't so bad.
But they thought he'd go to heaven.
Sure. That's a complicated story. It's interesting, you know, Martin Luther King's the guy that said that the most segregated hour is church. Churches are segregated. Frederick Douglass, it's worth reading, gang. Frederick Douglass' slave narrative, the narrative of Frederick Douglass, tells about the worst slave owners are Christians and people who got reborn. And he tells about one of his masters who's a good guy, but treats his slave, I mean, good. You know, I mean, he loves his kids, right? But he still beats his slaves. But he got reborn, and then he really beat his slaves because he had, what, religious justification. I mean, by misreading the Bible and so on. Anyway, a response to that, to your observation, he thought he was going to heaven, sure. But if this were a church, the black people are going to be sitting up there. And the white people are down here. That's one kind of, and that might be in one county. The next county over, you can't even go to church. I mean, they won't allow it. So, here. Where am I? 49. They talks a heap about the niggers stealing. Well, you know what was the first stealing done? It was in Africa when the white folks stole the niggers just like you'd get a drove of horses and sell them. I read that one, as short as it is, only because I think, well, Ulrich Phillips and lots of people who looked at slavery thought that slaves didn't know any better than slavery. Well, that's, as your story indicated last night, that's a whole lot of nonsense. I mean, what are these people, stupid? Then you can look over there and say, no, this isn't right. And here it is. You talk about stealing. You. Well, you got the point. Just a couple more. I've read lots of slave narratives, and the fear is the dominant emotion among slaves, I think. I mean, love is the dominant emotion, but in terms of anxieties, fear is. And the fear is not of being whipped, not of being locked up in the stocks. Guess. Being sold. Because then you're stuck. I can live in the stocks. I mean, the spiritual toughness is incredible, and the more slave narratives you read, the more you realize it. But being sold means there goes mama. There goes my daughter.
And if you ever saw Roots, and if you haven't, you younger folks, it was on in the 70s, you can get it at Blockbuster, you can get it anywhere, get it. And watch that great scene when, you remember this, you guys have seen it, Kizzy is on the street crawling down in the dirt after her daughter being hauled away on a wagon. You know, we all love people, imagine that loved one being hauled away. I saw a slave sold. I can see that old block now. My cousin Eliza was a pretty girl, really good looking. Her master was her father. When the girls in the big house had beaus coming to see him, they'd ask, who is that pretty gal? So they decided to get rid of her right away. The day they sold her will always be remembered. They stripped her to be bit off and looked at. I wasn't allowed to stand in the crowd. I was laying down under a fig bush. The man that bought Eliza was from New York. The Negroes had made up enough money to buy her off themselves, but the white folks wouldn't let that happen. There was a man bidding for her that was from Swedland. He always bid for the good-looking colored gals and bought them for his own use. He asked the man from New York, what you gonna do with her when you get her? The man from New York said, none of your damn business, but you ain't got money enough to buy her from me. When the man from New York had done bought her, he said, Eliza, you are free from now on. She left and went to New York with him. Mama and Eliza both cried when she was being showed off, and Master told him to shut up before he knocked the brains out. So in that case, she's sold to go up north. It's worse to be sold to go south. And the last one. Man, folks what didn't go through slavery ain't got no idea what it was. That Albert Phillips should have heard that. You know, I'm gonna write you a definitive book about slavery, but I'm not gonna ask any slave what it was like. Man, folks what didn't go through slavery ain't got no idea what it was. I reckon there must have been 100 colored folks in that trader yard, and the dirt and smell was terrible, terrible. I was just a little chap, like I told you, but I can remember that place like it happened yesterday. Husbands sold away from wives and children taken away from mothers. A trader them days didn't think no more of selling a baby or a little child away from his mother than taking a little calf away from a cow. Well, okay, in 5 minutes you've got the truth, and the truth shall make you free. And we can't any longer even guess that, you know, slavery really wasn't so bad. And then what poets talk about, and that's where we are now, and where we'll look at stuff together and you'll get to hear some things. The poets are about, let's talk about what has been called in academia, but also on the streets, the black experience, now the African-American experience. depending on who you talk to, if it's black or if it's African-American. I have lots of students who say, I don't want African-American on me. I'm black, and there'll be debates, and I just stand aside and let them talk, and they got to do what they got to do. Anyway, the poets now are going to address this. This is the black experience in America, and no one does it with more powerful images than Richard Wright does. In I want to read this first because we don't want to end on it. Black poets, for sure, are conscious of oppression. They are conscious of violence, and they are conscious of both of those in their own lives. This one is about violence and oppression. But that's not all that they write about. Poets write, and we'll look at some of that too, great things about love and honesty and honor, all the things that all poets write. We all, as poets, write out of the experiences of our lives. And Richard Wright grew up in the South, and this imaginative poem, I'll read it straight through without stopping, but I'll set it up for you. The speaker of the poem, I'm going to back up and tell you a story. For 12 years, I had a one-man play that I took all over the United States. And I had, the play was 90 minutes of, you think it put you to sleep, and I think it probably did. No. it's 90 minutes of poetry. The poetry was a journey, and the play was called A Pilgrimage with Poets. And the poem I'm going to read for you was one of those poems there. And I had always introduced that poem to the audience by saying what I'm going to tell you right now. The poet is black, it's Richard Wright, and he has the setting for the poem is stumbled upon the remains of a lynching. There are ropes and bones and ashes and other things that I'll just let you feel the power of his images. And then he imagines what it must have been like, and his imagination takes him away into the night that it happened, and he hears the dogs, and he feels the ropes, and he feels the flames leaping up on his body. And one night doing this play in Michigan, There were a lot of black people in the audience, and five of those black people I knew very well. We were teaching together at an institute. And I started to talk about the, I introduced the play the way I always did, and, or the poem. And when I did the poem, it's from memory, I wasn't the poet, the black poet. I was a white man stumbling upon the remains of a lynching. And for those of you who are in this room, when I read this poem, be who you are. Don't try to become the poet stumbling upon the remains. Be who you are. And the last lines are, now I am dry bones, and my face a stony skull staring in yellow surprise at the sun. It's, I'm talking like an English teacher for a second, it's the universality and the power of art to transcend racial or gender difference. And you will feel the lynching. Okay, enough of me, let's hear Richard Wright. Mm-hmm. And one morning while in the woods, I stumbled suddenly upon the thing. Stumbled upon it in a grassy clearing guarded by scaly oaks and elms, and the sooty details of the scene rose, thrusting themselves between the world and me. There was a design of white bone slumbering forgottenly upon a cushion of ashes. There was a charred stump of a sapling pointing a blunt finger accusingly at the sky. There were torn tree limbs, tiny veins of burnt leaves, and a scorched coil of greasy hemp, a vacant shoe, an empty tie, a ripped shirt, a lonely hat, and a pair of trousers stiff with black blood. And upon the trampled grass were buttons, dead matches, butt ends of cigars and cigarettes, peanut shells, a drained gin flask, and a whore's lipstick. Scattered traces of tar, restless arrays of feathers, and the lingering smell of gasoline. And through the morning air, the sun poured yellow surprise into the eye sockets of a stony skull. And while I stood, my mind was frozen with a cold pity for the life that was gone. The ground gripped my feet, and my heart was circled with icy walls of fear. The sun died in the sky. A night wind muttered in the grass and fumbled the leaves in the trees. The woods poured forth the hungry yelping of hounds. The darkness screamed with thirsty voices, and the witnesses rose and lived. The dry bones stirred, rattled, lifted, melting themselves into my bones. The gray ashes formed flesh, firm and black, entering into my flesh. The gin flask passed from mouth to mouth. Cigars and cigarettes glowed. The whore smeared the lipstick red upon her lips. And a thousand faces swirled around me, clamoring that my life be burned. And then they had me, stripped me, battering my teeth into my throat till I swallowed my own blood. My voice was drowned in the roar of their voices, and my black, wet body slipped and rolled in their hands as they bound me to the sapling. And my skin clung to the bubbling hot tar, falling from me in limp patches, and the down and quills of the white feathers sank into my raw flesh, and I moaned in my agony. And then my blood was cooled mercifully, cooled by a baptism of gasoline, and in a blaze of red I leaped to the sky as pain rose like water, boiling my limbs, panting, begging, I clutched childlike, clutched to the hot sides of death. Now I am dry bones, and my face a stony skull staring in yellow surprise at the sun. Your turn. Without even, you don't have it in front of you, name an image you remember.
Yellow eye sockets.
Eye sockets.
The pointing stump.
Single tree pointing up.
Peanut shells.
Peanut shell. How can you forget it? It's a circus. Richard Wright's story, Big Boy Leaves Home. Come on, pour on more gas. I'm going to get me a souvenir. And we know what those souvenirs were. Fingers, penises, toes.
I see crowds.
Crowds. Voices shouting. A thousand voices swirled around me, clamoring that my life be burned. we'll move on because there, that's why we start with that and we don't end there. The power of poetry rides on its images. Those concrete, good poets will never talk about love and honor. I mean, we use those words about love and honor and dedication and hope and violence. Those are abstractions. They're going to make it concrete for us. They're going to make it so that we experience not just something about life, but I suspect as you sat there listening to that, you experience something not just about somebody else, but yourself. Anybody get goosebumps? Anybody get sick? Anybody? Oh my God. Whatever it is, you experience something. And I would underline for you that stories and art are not only about an experience. Last night's storytelling is a great example, and if a literary critic were to come up, and I'll be one for a moment, and say what you did to us last night, you didn't just tell stories about Africa. You created an experience for us right there. And we had an experience that was not only about Africa, but it was our own right there. So, the phrase, this poetry is not only about experience, it is an experience. And a good poet, a good storyteller makes that happen. Okay. We'll go to yours to give you a chance to shine, you guys. But one of the things that I have students do is write their own poetry. Most of the students in these classes are not English majors. And they all say what? I can't write poetry. We don't do it in class. They have to do it on their own. There's a wonderful documentary called Eyes on the Prize. And it's there's 13 now. But the first series of those, their documentary is narrated by Julian Bond. And the first one is about Emmett Till. And Emmett Till is the young kid from Chicago who went down south and, they say, sassed a white woman. He didn't. But that white woman went home and told her husband, the little kid from Chicago, he's 14 years old, doesn't have a clue what he's saying. He's used to talking to white people the way you talk to anybody. And he talked to a white woman in the south. The husband came to his uncle's door, he was staying with his uncle, and said, is that boy here? Yep. And they took him out and killed him. And then they tied him to a fan and stuck him in the river, and they sunk him. And here's what one of those students, not an English major, wrote. And this one we did quite a while ago. It was when E.T., the movie E.T., came out, remember? Well, E.T. is also Emmett Till. E.T. didn't get to ride in Elliot's basket past the moon. Remember the movie, you guys? And E.T. phoned home in the basket. Okay. E.T. didn't get to ride in Elliot's basket past the moon. He floated down the Mississippi on his raft, fashioned out of a cotton gin fan. He left swinging, beaten through the forest, and was sent home in a casket after the heinous experiments of two scientists, two manly walruses in clean white skins like Hitler's lab techies in Auschwitz. And that's the two guys, this husband and, her, and his brother, so the brother-in-law of the sassed woman, sat in court and were acquitted, of course, by a 12 all-male, all-white jury. I should have said that before that, so we'll run this by. I was sent home in a casket after the heinous experiments of two scientists, two manly walruses in clean white skins like Hitler's lab techies in Auschwitz. We all saw this creature they dragged from the water. The bloated, superhuman face peered forth from the picture with protruding eyes and the ring that told us who he was. Identity can bring murder. And then before I finish this, one of the great things, and it's in the video, and you see is that this guy's uncle's name was Mose, M-O-S-E, and Mose was illiterate, but the attorney said, can you point to the men who came to get your nephew? And he stood up and said, dar he. Still didn't get him acquitted, but the poem here, does it? Identity can bring murder. And Grandpa Mose, like a late coming Elliot, pointed through the thickened courtroom saying, dar he, they the guys killed E.T. The men in white skins raised their scalpels to the threat of their smirking, stable stances. He was an evil, most dangerous species. He said, bye, baby, to our white lady. He could have done fornicated with our kind. Mm-hmm. The Dar-He's ringing truth, like a pistol shot, a pulpy pain, the final crack, 12 white cloaked men let the two go free. That's a poem of a kid who can't write poetry. An injustice has been done, innocence lost with one phrase, torture, mutilation, buried with a cotton fan. He got what he deserved, injustice. An injustice has been done, innocence lost with one phrase, torture, mutilation, buried with a cotton fan. They got to go home. One more. This is not by a kid. This is a real live, well, those are real live poets too. This is a published poet. Sterling Brown. It's a wonderful story. I think it's one of the great poems in all of American literature. It's called Remembering Nat Turner. And who's Nat Turner? Anybody study that? Know that?
Runaway slave.
Yep. A slave, stage of slave revolt. And it was unsuccessful. But it was successful enough, they killed 60 people. It had got going, and the truth of the revolt has, they've tried, the white folks in the South tried to suppress it because they sure didn't want the word to get out that this could be successful. And they also didn't want the word to get out to other slaves. I mean, this is a preposterous notion, but they thought this way. They didn't want the word to get out to other slaves to make them think that, you mean we really can revolt? I mean, that's one of the options in the way we live our existence. So this story called Remembering Nat Turner takes place in 1940. And Sterling Brown, the date doesn't matter except that it's modern times, hops in a car with some black friends and drives down to where the revolt took place, and they just want to walk the steps of the revolt. And we have this, you'll get all the feelings of it. Two things we should know, that the revolt took place in Jerusalem, they changed the name of the city to Cortland now. Cross Keys is another city that it started at. It started out at Cross Keys, came down upon Jerusalem. Another word that some of you might not know is the word goober is peanut, and a white woman talks about the peanut market. She uses the word goober. And the rest to note in the poem, and I believe that you can hear poetry, you don't have to have it in front of you. Some poems you do. But the great ones that are kind of stage poems, you don't have to have in front of you. Because the poet's not after your intellect. The poet is after your emotion and your spirit and what I like to call your guts. So let your guts work on this one. The one thing, I guess, intellectually to know is that the relationship between legend and exaggeration and truth, legend, exaggeration, and truth, are all mixed up here. And why is the truth suppressed still? Okay, these guys are in their car, and here it goes. We saw a bloody sunset over Cortland, once Jerusalem, as we followed the trail that old Nat took when he came out of Cross Keys down upon Jerusalem in his angry stab for freedom 100 years ago. The land was quiet and the mist was rising out of the woods in the Nottoway Swamp. Over Southampton, the still night fell as we rode down to Cross Keys where the march began. When we got to Cross Keys, they could tell us little of him. The Negroes had only the faintest recollections. I ain't been here so long. I come up from round Newsom. Yes, a town a few miles up the road. The old folks who could have told you is all dead and gone. I heard something sometime. I don't just remember what. Appears like I heard that name somewheres or other. So, he fought to be free. Well, you don't say. An old white woman recalled exactly how Nat crept down the steps, axe in his hand, after murdering a woman and child in bed. Right in this here house at the head of these stairs. In a house built long after Nat was dead. She pointed to a brick store where Nat was captured. Nat was taken in the swamp 10 miles away. With his men around him shooting from the windows, she was thinking of Harper's Ferry and old John Brown. She cackled as she told how they riddled Nat with bullets. Nat was tried and hanged in Cortland 10 miles away. She wanted to know why folks would come miles just to ask about an old nigger fool. There ain't no slavery no more. Things is going all right, provided there's a good goober market this year. We had a signpost here with printing on it, but it rotted in the hole and there it lays. And the nigger tenants split the marker for kindling. Things is all right now. Ain't no trouble with the niggers. Why they make this big to-do over Nat? As we drove from Cross Keys back to Cortland along the way that Nat came down upon Jerusalem, a watery moon was high in the cloud-filled heavens, the same moon he dreaded 100 years ago. The tree they hang Nat on is long gone to ashes. The trees he dodged behind have rotted in the swamps. The bus for Miami and the trucks boomed by, and touring cars, their heavy tires snarling on the pavement, frogs piped in the marshes, and a hound bayed long, and yellow lights glowed from cabin windows. And as we came back the way that Nat led his army down from Cross Keys down to Jerusalem, we wondered if his troubled spirit still roamed the Nottoway, or if it fled with the cockcrow at daylight, or lay at peace with the bones in Jerusalem in restlessness stifled by Southampton clay. We remembered the poster rotted through and falling, the marker split for kindling a kitchen fire. What do you feel?
What do you think?
How hard it is to find the truth. I mean, here's somebody supposedly telling you the truth. And,
yeah.
You know, because we want that concrete, here's where it happened, here's this, here's that, how much we lose. It made me not want to, it made me not trust a lot of museums or something.
Yeah. A lot of books, 529 pages, 600 footnotes, and better not trust them. Yeah, really. Yeah. Storytellers.
And that people don't know that they're not telling the truth. Because I'm sure that woman, she believed it.
Yeah, very good.
That was how it happened.
They don't know and they don't care either. Good.
Comment about goobers was reminiscent of today. That you can tolerate any injustice as long as the economy is
very good. Yep. Yeah. Here's a good move. No trouble with niggers as long as there's a good goober market. Clayton's video. No trouble with the blacks as long as we got they're buying 30% of my beer. It is cosmic slop. Anything else?
Just man's inhumanity to man. Told again. It just makes me cringe inside.
Yeah. Did Nat want to do this?
Well, he was desperate.
Great point. As controversial as it is, it's a tremendous book. That is William Styron's Confessions of Nat Turner, but there are other things to read about Nat Turner, too. Nat Turner was a prophet, a deeply committed believer, had many, many parts, more than any of us, probably all of us, put together of the Bible memorized. And this poet, he must have known that. As we came back down that way that Nat led his army down from Cross Keys down to Jerusalem, we wondered if his troubled spirit, your word is desperate. Lord, I don't want to do this. Some of you were in a session a couple days ago reading about the black guy who was cornered and said, I'm going to be here and I'm going to be hard, but Lord, I don't want to be this way. It's good, desperate. Anything else?
People who are prophets, you know, raise their hand and say, I want to be a prophet. They are maligned and tortured, but they are bound by the Spirit to do what they say, what they say.
Great point. Great point. Thank you. That's great.
There was that movie we watched called This If These Walls Could Talk, too, and it was about gay relationships. And one of the women was saying this, it was in the 60s, and there was a woman, but she was dressing like a man. But she wasn't really a man or a woman. She was just who she was. And all these other gay women were saying, wouldn't it just be easier if you just dressed like a woman? And she said, no, that makes it harder. Do you think I want to dress like this? No, but that's who I am. And that's how I have to be. So, it's harder to try and lie to yourself.
Yeah. So Nat has to do this. He's gonna lead people to murder. He knows. But if the more slave narratives we read, we know the slaves are not going to be murderers, but they are, a gentle word is coerced, forced, desperate into that situation. Good, Martha.
I'm having a terrible time personally right now with all this, and I feel that there's something about hearing you read it that absolutely panics me. And I realized that I was first influenced and thinking about all this by reading Uncle Tom's Cabin, and then I read a few other things as I got a little bit older, and I recognize this feeling I'm having now is the one I had then, and there's I need you to talk more about what happens to people when they have, when they're faced by the feelings that are evoked by this kind of literature, because I realize that I have almost turned away from it as I got older because it is so painful.
Mm-hmm. I think Desmond Tutu's book, I pushed it to the right too, No Future Without Forgiveness, it would be, would help. It's about grace, and the hardest person to give grace to is yourself, mm-hmm. I think. I'll share with you an experience, and I'll read a poem to share the experience. The first black poem I ever read was read to me by a black militant teacher who was also a poet himself. Let's see. It was this. And here's this white boy from Minnesota sitting in a class of African-American men called Black Poetry, led by this black militant poet. It's Nikki Giovanni. I'll read it as I've heard her read it. Nigger, can you kill? Can you kill? Can a nigger kill? Can a nigger kill a honky? Can a nigger kill a man? Can you kill, nigger, huh? Nigger, can you kill? Do you know how to draw blood? Can you poison? Can you stab a Jew? Can you kill, huh, nigger? Can you kill? Can you run a Protestant down with their 68 Eldorado? That's all they're good for anyway. Can you kill? Can you piss on a blonde head? Can you cut it off? Can you kill? A nigger can die. We ain't got to prove we can die. We got to prove we can kill. They sent us to kill Japan and Africa. We policed Europe. Can you kill? Can you kill a white man? Can you kill the nigger in you? Can you make your nigger mind die? Can you kill your nigger mind and free your black hands to strangle? Can you kill? Can a nigger kill? Can you shoot straight and fire for good measure? Can you splatter their brains in the street? Can you kill them? Can you lure them to bed to kill them? We killed in Vietnam for them. We killed for UN and NATO and CETO and US and everywhere for all the alphabet but B-L-A-C-K. Can we learn to kill white for black? Can we learn to kill niggers? Learn to be black men? That's my first one. I have a response and just to share an experience is, if we're white, there's some places we can go and some places we can't. But we can't be afraid, I guess, to go where we can go. And I'm not even sure I know what I mean by that, but there are some things that we can't feel, that we can't experience. And so, you know, art can make things happen vicariously, but it's still, art is different than the reality. but I guess my personal response to your question, I feel that, what you feel, I feel every single class that starts. Not only, I mean, the beginning of the year. I mean, there are black kids out there who are looking at this white honky from Minnesota saying, who the hell are you? What have you done that makes you think you can do this? And that anxiety, that fear, and yet, I don't know, I guess I think I'm called. You gotta do this. And there are black people who do it, and there are white people who do it, and they both got to do it. And the anxiety and the pain and the mistakes that we make along the way, I guess, are just part of the process. And the disturbance that you feel is part of that process, too. Surely the poet wanted us to be disturbed. Mm-hmm. Can you kill? And she's also talking to black people. Can you kill your nigger mind? Can you free, and you know, there's a book back in the 70s, you guys read it, The Student as Nigger, that white people can be niggers too. Mm-hmm. That is, your mind is enslaved and you can't see another paradigm for life. You can't see, if the paradigm were in English literature, you can't see past the Frosts and the Sandburgs and the Shakespeares. And we gotta have a whole new, your nigger mind, instead there's other literature that's written by white women, that's written by Indians, you know the story. So the bottom line to all of this stuff, I guess, and this is where I'll stop and go back to poetry. personally come from in relating to this stuff is these poets are not hopeless. And they might be angry, as Nikki Giovanni is. They might be Wake Up America, as Richard Wright is, when I suddenly stumbled upon the things, you know, in the grassy clearing. And they're going to talk about oppression and they're going to tell the truth. But if they were cynical and hopeless, they wouldn't bother to write this poem. And so the ultimate act of creation, that is, create the poem or the story, is an act, sounds hokey, it's an act of love, it's an act of freedom, it's an act of hope. You know, we hear my poem, says Richard Wright, and you will, you have, just in that 5 minutes, you will change.
I want to go back to the poem, so if we're not done with this.
We're done.
I came in, well, you were already reading the poem, so I might have missed something important, but it seems to me that the story, you said something about everybody's story is different. The story of the white woman in that poem is her story.
Yeah.
And she believes it. It's her story probably of her community. It's a story that the poet uses to show us one version of racism.
Yeah.
And a kind of a cohesive system of thought that leads to that. And by laying that out in the poem, the poet is implying that people believe stuff. And it's part of the air they breathe, mm-hmm. and the ground they're planted in. Which is not true.
Right.
I mean, he's dealing with historical fact here, and so it's interesting that he puts that in there, and that too, the story, the story within the story, the white woman's version,
yep.
is also historical fact. I mean, even though the building had been burned or was no longer there, he'd already been dead before the building was built, whatever. So it's an interesting set of ideas that the poet is giving to us about the way people believe their own stories and come out of their own stories, even though historically they're completely inaccurate.
That's
a comment on human nature.
Yeah, that's a great assessment of the poem and of art itself. And you already said it better than I can. Why does he do this? And here's the title of this little session. You shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free of her. I mean, she's living a lie, believing a lie. There's no trouble with the niggers. That's a lie. Should we do, we got just time to do it, I think. Let's do Middle Passage. It's a wonderful poem, and we have time, and you guys can share it. And we do. It's about a 10-minute poem. You guys who are reading, just read the parts that are highlighted, and I'm sorry I took the long part, but rather than dump it on you, the first look, we'll go. If I had you guys together for an hour, I would do this poem a little bit differently than we're, and then I'd have you all sing softly. We don't want to do it though, because you'll be distracted from the language. The hymn, Jesus Savior, pilot me. If that could, but just think about that. That is going on underneath the poem all the time. Pilot me over life's tempestuous sea. Okay, the story here is, this is the story of the Amistad Mutiny, and if you saw the movie, this is about that. The slaves are loaded on the ship, and they're on the Middle Passage, the part that you talked about so well last night, from Africa to the Americas, and they revolt, and they win in the revolt. So they tell their guys, they leave two guys alive and say, take us back to Africa. And so these guys sail east in the daytime, but west at night, and they end up in America. That's the plot of the story. The poem itself will speak powerfully to you about the Middle Passage. This is the history of the Middle Passage in art, and it's better than any history book that I've ever read about it. Okay, who we got doing this? Okay, here we go. Those are the names of those things. You have the italicized ones. Sue, is that right?
Wendy,
I mean.
I have reader two.
Who?
Reader one.
Okay, you've got that. Okay, the very first things: Jesu, Estrella, Esperanza, and Mercy are the names of ships. And that's probably all we need to know. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Oh, deep in the festering hole thy father lies.
Do you have one up above that? Didn't I highlight one? At the very very top?
Just a line.
That's it. Start that. We're just going to read through the whole thing. Just read your line, and we're going to go back and forth. You read your...
Jesu esperanza mercy.
Sails flashing to the wind like weapons. Sharks following the moans, the fever, and the dying. Horror the corpuscent. Encompass roads.
Middle passage, voyage through death to life upon these shores. And now he quotes the captain's diary. 10 April 1800, blacks rebellious, crew uneasy. Our linguist says their moaning is a prayer for death, ours and their own. Some try to starve themselves, lost three this morning, leaped with crazy laughter to the waiting sharks, sang as they went under.
Desire, adventure, Tatar, and...
Standing to America, bringing home black gold, black ivory, black seed.
Deep in the festering hole thy father lies, of his bone New England pews are made. Those are altar lights that were his eyes.
Jesus, Savior, pilot me o'er life's tempestuous sea. We pray that thou wilt grant, O Lord, safe passage to our vessels, bringing heathen souls onto thy chastening. Jesus, Savior.
I won't stop us, but just note the irony that they use, that these are heathen mm-hmm. souls, and later they're going to throw these people overboard. More of a diary. 8 bells. I cannot sleep, for I am sick with fear, but writing eases fear a little, since still my eyes can see these words take shape upon the page. And so I write, as one would turn to exorcism. 4 days scudding, but now the sea is calm again. Misfortune follows in our wake like sharks. Which one of us has killed an albatross? A plague among our blacks, blindness. And we have jettisoned the blind to no avail. It spreads, the terrifying sickness spreads, and its claws have scratched sight from the captain's eyes, and there is blindness in the fo'sle. And we must sail 3 weeks before we come to port.
What port awaits us, Davy Jones, or home? I've heard of slavers drifting, playthings of wind and storm and chance, their crews gone blind, the jungle hatred crawling up on the deck.
Thou who walked on Galilee.
Oh, great. Deponent further saith, the Bella J left the Guinea coast with cargo of 500 blacks and odd for the barracoons of Florida. The barracoons are those cages. That there was hardly room between decks for half the sweltering cattle stowed spoon fashion there, that some went mad of thirst and tore their flesh and sucked the blood. That crew and captain lusted with the comeliest of the savage girls kept naked in the cabins. That there was one they called the Guinea Rose, and they cast lots and fought to lie with her. That when the boatswain piped, all hands, the flames spreading from starboard already were beyond control, the Negroes howling and their chains entangled with the flames, that the burning blacks could not be reached, that the crew abandoned ship, leaving their shrieking negresses behind, that the captain perished drunken with the wenches, further deponent saith not.
Pilot, oh pilot me.
Aye, lad. And I have seen those factories, Gambia, Rio Pongo, Calabar, have watched the artful Mongols baiting traps of war wherein the victor and the vanquished were caught, that's the men and women, as prizes for our barracoons. I've seen the nigger kings whose vanity and greed turned wild black hides of Felata, Mandingo, Ibu, crew to gold for us. And there was one, King Anthracite, we named him, fetish face beneath French parasols of brass and orange velvet, impudent mouth, whose cups were carven skulls of enemies. These are the things he traded these men for. He'd honor us with drum and feast and conjo and palm oil, glistening wenches who were deft in love, and for 10 crowns that shone with paste red calico and German silver trinkets. Would have the drums talk war and send his warriors to burn the sleeping villages and kill the sick and old and leave the young in coffles to our factories. 20 years a trader, 20 years, for there was wealth of plenty to be harvested from those black fields. And I'd be trading still but for the fevers melting down my bones. Shuttles in the rocking loom of history, the dark ships move, their bright, ironical names like jests of kindness on a murderer's mouth. Plow through thrashing glister toward Fata Morgana's lucent melting shore, weave toward new world shores that are mirage and myth. And actual shore.
Voyage through death, voyage whose chartings are unloved. A charnel stench, effluvium of living death, spreads outward from the hold, where the living and the dead the horribly dying lie interlocked, lie foul with blood and excrement.
Deep in the festering hold thy father lies, the corpse of mercy rots with him. Rats eat love's rotten, jealous eyes. But all the living look at you with human eyes whose suffering accuses you, whose hatred reaches through the swirl of dark to strike you like a leper's claw. You cannot stir that hatred down or chain the fear that stalks the watches and breathe on you its fetid, scorching breath. You cannot kill the deep, immortal human wish, the timeless will.
But for the storm that flung up barriers of wind and wave, the Amistad, senors, would have reached the port of Principe in 2-3 days at most. But for the storm, we should have been prepared for what befell. Swift as the puma's leap it came, there was that interval of moonless calm filled only with the waters and the rigging's usual sounds. Then sudden movement, blows and snarling cries, and they had fallen on us with machete and marlin spike. It was as though the very air, the night itself, were striking us. Exhausted by the rigors of the storm, we were no match for them. Our men went down before the murderous Africans. Our loyal Celestino ran from below with gun and lantern, and I saw, before the keen knife's wounding flash, Cinquez, that surly brute who calls himself a prince, directing, urging on the ghastly work. Look at the irony in this. He turned on me. He hacked the poor mulatto down, and then he turned on me. The decks were slippery when daylight finally came. It sickens me to think of what I saw, of how those apes threw overboard the butchered bodies of our true men, true Christians all, like so much jetsam. Enough, enough, the rest is quickly told. Cinquez was forced to spare the two of us, you see, to steer the ship to Africa. And we, like phantoms doomed to rove the sea, voyaged east by day and west by night, deceiving them, hoping for rescue, prisoners on our own vessel, till at length we drifted to the shores of this, your land, America, where we were freed from our unspeakable misery. Now we demand, good sirs, the extradition of Cinquez and his accomplices to La Habana. And it distresses us to know there are so many here who seem inclined to justify the mutiny of these blacks. We find it paradoxical indeed that you, whose wealth, whose tree of liberty are rooted in the labor of your slaves, should suffer the august John Quincy Adams to speak with so much passion of the right of chattel slaves to kill their lawful masters. And with his Roman rhetoric, weave a hero's garland for Cinquez. I tell you that we are determined to return to Cuba with our slaves and there see justice done. Cinquez, or let us say the Prince Cinquez, shall die.
The deep, immortal human wish, the timeless will, Cinquez, its deathless, primeval image, life that transfigures many lives, voyage through death to life upon these shores.
Is that good little passage stuff?
Yes, that is.
It's 10, but anybody have anything we can, you know, you're free to leave. Anybody responses to this? Did you know about the middle passage before? Did you know about it?
I thought it was a book by Charles Johnson.
It is.
that is one, but there is also another book of the middle passage I think you should look at. It's written by
Tom Feelings.
Tom Feelings is a teacher that draws a lot for school. That's my wife that said that. She's heard it a million times. And I do have the book with me. You might want to take a look at it. And anyway, Tom Feelings has drawn, written this book. It's more of a pictorial book, and I would call it a horrendously beautiful book. It really is a picture, the more you look at it. When I talk about, and many things I didn't say last night because we had children there, but the thing that are covered in this poem here,
right.
It's just sort of interesting what I did last night and to hear this today, how much of a connection there is.
I would have done this had you not done it. You set me up.
Oh, praise the Lord.
Yeah, right.
That's the way it's supposed to work in Hollywood.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, Howard Johnson's middle passage, not Howard, Thomas.
Charles Johnson.
Yeah, his middle passage is quite a different story. It's a sort of opportunist.
Yeah, right.
It's not really the middle passage as such. So you need to relook at the book by Tom Feelings. Then you see the pictures. I have them with me if you ever want to look at it. And you feel it, and the more you look at it, the more you feel it, the more you become a part of it. Like the first bit of what you read, the lynching.
Yeah.
And you become a part of that. Oh, wow.
Just one quick addition. Nigger, can you kill? Can you kill nigger? Can you kill a honky? Can you piss on all that ugly rhetorical, radical stuff? My own sense of that is that that's true to the Gospels. Jesus asks again and again and again for their most radical behavior. Sell all you have. Love me more than you. Think of all of how radical he is. And he's telling us that, you know, there's a whole other way to look at stuff. You know, you shall not live by bread alone, and we all do, right? Give me my bread and my house and my white shutters and my golden retriever and all that. And so they're true to the Gospel of the radical new paradigms. And the other thing, that's one point, and the other thing to make, just so you have a sense of, can you get a sense in 50 minutes, of African-American poetry. Nicky Giovanni, who wrote Can You Kill, Can a Nigger Kill, also wrote, this is, I don't have it memorized, but, come on, chocolate drop, she's talking to her baby and she's going to tuck him into bed. Mm. It's time for a nap. And then she describes this baby lying on her chest, and he's rolling and tossing and turning, and she talks to him and coos him and tickles his chin. And then the last line is, and there, just before I fall asleep. But it's a wonderful, gentle love poem. And you need to just hear, I wish I had the poem with me, but I don't. Need to hear that side of her, too. That this is this angry revolutionary who, that's not her only calling in life. And I just thought of this, Richard Wright, who wrote this, you know, Native Son, Black Boy, this poem. I mean, his novel, Native Son, gives rise to the literary critic that uses the phrase protest novel. This guy who's most against America, who's socialist, who's communist, who anything he can be but a capitalist, goes through every route that there is, all his life is happily married to a white woman, understanding that the system and individuals, it's a different thing, and that you have to go after. We never want to come away thinking that that the black experience in America is one-dimensional or simple. It's as complex as all the forests and more. Anyway, you're a great audience. Thank you.